thankful that you're of the mind to be with us. If you have your notebooks, you might turn to page 14. And I thought I'd just give a very brief run through of the outline for the week. It's certainly a flexible outline. When we were planning this meeting, we almost didn't put this section in. Because we've had sections on the family about every two-week meeting that I can remember. The problem is, when we took a look at it and then looked at the church and the mess we is in, it's pretty hard to ignore the family. Bill Hensley yesterday was making a comment in his talk about one of the most tragic things that he sees as he looks back, is congregations that don't have men ready for the office of elder and or deacon. I don't know that this is the prime reason, but it's in the top two. Men who ought to be in the office of elder and deacon, but aren't qualified because of their family situation. And I don't know how cutting I want to get with that, but I don't have to go outside of this auditorium to see men who ought to be in the office of the church, but aren't because of their family situation. So it's serious. But I've tried to put some things in our conversation this week that at least I haven't dealt with previously. If on page 14, which we'll be working out of today, we have somewhat of an overview, but I want to talk about headship, the style of headship, egalitarian marriages, are they biblical, submission, headship, and love. Section 2, and I didn't make this day 2, is page 15, because I don't know, we may do more than one of these in a day, has to do with myths about marriage, dating in the home. I'll probably hit that one a little bit harder with the young people downstairs, but divorces seem to occur in people over the age of 25 more than people under the age of 25. Section 3 is one I've never really taught, but I've had a lot of requests for, so I put it in here. I called it blended families. What we're going to be dealing with are families who have children that aren't the natural birth children of both parents, divorce, adoption, homes that have been put together through death, situations where the children aren't all the blood relative of both the husband and the wife. In our congregation here, I just did a quick count. We probably got, 7 to 10 families that I'd put in this category. And that's not derogatory. It's just the way that it's worked out for those families. And it brings some special problems. How to be a stepmother. How to be a stepfather. How to be a stepchild. Section 4 is the section on wounded parents. I've never spent an entire day on this, but we may. How do parents deal with heartbreak when their children, as they become adults and leave the nest, don't follow in the Lord's steps as they had been taught or as parents had hoped they would be? Proverbs 22:6 will deal with that. That's been mentioned a couple of times already. I have a little different take on that passage than I think I heard others expose on that. And I'll share with you my take on Proverbs 22:6. Section 5, I don't know how to deal with this topic without dealing with it. We will talk about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. That will be either Thursday or Friday, depending upon how we move along. What does it mean to marry only in the Lord? Is blood thicker than water? Section 6 is simply a question and answer session. If we have time, we'll be dealing Friday with various questions that have come up throughout the week. I would like for you to ask your questions as we go along this week. But I know, having said that, some of you are either shy or some issues are so personal that you don't want to raise your hand and have everybody think of you when this question comes up. So if you want to submit a question to me, feel free to. We'll try to discuss that question without it having necessarily an attachment to you. You know, you can ask the question and say, a friend of mine has this problem, but everyone kind of knows that when we say a friend of mine has this problem, that it's a little closer to home than that. So I encourage your participation. This is going to be more interactive than Gnosticism, simply because you know more about this than you knew about Gnosticism. And even if you don't know anything about it, you have an opinion. And both of those lead to comments. But I do encourage that. I always like to start a session like this by a little bit like the comment Rick made regarding various religions. This is a very touchy issue, and there's not a family here that hasn't been touched directly with heartbreak as it relates to the family. I know most of you medium to very well, and I don't know that I can look out just scanning the audience and see a family that hasn't been touched relatively closely by divorce, breakup of family, rebellious children. You just go down the list, and that includes my family. So we're not talking at one another, we're simply visiting with one another, because this topic is paramount. I don't know of a congregation that doesn't wrestle with these problems and hasn't had their hearts broken by these problems. That doesn't mean it's going to be necessarily easy to discuss them, it just simply means it's a big boat and we're all in it. So if I happen to use an illustration that is U to the T, it's coincidental. And it probably applies to more than simply you or simply to I. This class will, and this will be my job, to have a balance between discussion and presenting material. Because I could conduct this whole week by just asking you leading questions, and each one of those questions would give rise to 10 or 15 minutes of discussion. And after four questions, I could sit down and four times five, I only need 20 questions and the week's over. But I do feel compelled to try to present you some material. So we'll try to take all of the comments and all of the questions as we can, but I know that in a class such as this, there'll be times when I'll have to simply make a call and say, let's move on, and then we can continue throughout the week to have these as side questions. But I don't want you to be inhibited from asking questions. We're here to edify one another. And I don't have all of the answers. And anybody that doubts that, there's a lady in the second row here that can vouch for the fact that I don't have all of the answers. And to the extent that I present you material that makes sense, you need to do what I say and not what I do. And your marriage will be much better. Okay. With that, I always like to start a session such as this in the following manner, and I've done it in almost every session that I've held. I'd like for those of you that are married to let your minds drift back a few years, 50 years, to a time when you stood before a group, probably not too far like this one, and we're asked the following. Do you take, and you fill in the name, this one whose hand you now hold to be your lawfully wedded husband or wife? Do you promise before God and these witnesses that you will be true and devoted? Promise to love, honor, and cherish in sickness and in health, in prosperity and adversity, forsaking all others and cleave unto them and them only, till death do you part. And the question before us right now is, how are you doing on that commitment? Lord willing, Saturday night, I'll stand in front of two young people and say something very much like this to them. And they're going to look at me with starry eyes of wonderment and say, of course. And they don't really have a full idea of what lies in store for them, because you didn't and I didn't. And to some extent, it's impossible too, until you've entered into it. And those of us that have good marriages, to take a theme from Charles's talk on Friday night, it's probably one of the great graces God has given us. Because most of us, when we got married, we had some teaching on it, but for the grace of God, ours could have been a real mess. So if you happen to be blessed with a loving mate, that certainly deserves some good prayer time in thanksgiving to the Lord. Those of you that have lost your mates, if they were wonderful, loving mates that left you with wonderful memories, you've got something to really be thankful for. And I can take you to a lot of people that would give their right arm to trade places with you and to have those same memories. There's a passage. Would you hand me my Bible down below? Yeah, the real one. Okay. I'd like to go back to Proverbs chapter 30. The wisest man, or one of the wisest men, had to admit that this subject was a little bit perplexing to him. Proverbs chapter 30, verses 18 and 19. Solomon writes, "There are three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four that I don't understand. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a woman." Solomon didn't understand the interrelationship of men and women. And so maybe it's a little comforting for us when we struggle with that very same thing. I'm reminded of the story, or the joke, I guess you could say, about the man who was granted one wish, and he'd always wanted to go to Hawaii. And so but he was afraid to fly. So his one wish was that they would construct a 4-lane highway from LA to Honolulu so he could drive to Hawaii. And the grantor of the wish said, "That's just too hard. That's too hard. Pick another one." So he thought for a while and he said, "Okay, explain to me how women think." And the grantor of the wish said, "Do you want that to be a 4-lane or a 6-lane highway?" It's a perplexing thing, but it's a wonderful thing. One more, and then we'll move on from that. Little boy went to spend the weekend with his grandparents, and they went to a wedding on Saturday night, and then they took him to church on Sunday morning. And the preacher Sunday morning was talking about the sayings of Jesus as he hung on the cross. So when the little boy got home Monday, his mother was asking him, "What did you get out of the..." She was interested because this was the first wedding this little boy had gone to. And she asked the little boy, "What did you get? What did you see at the wedding?" And he said, "I can't remember much," but he got the two services mixed up. And all he could remember is the preacher said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." But that's certainly not a Christian marriage, and it's not a funny subject. And those of you that have been through, either personally or with your family, some of the heartache of broken homes, you know that this is not funny. We're going to try to help ourselves deal with it, to prevent it, and to understand it. I'd like to share with you just a little slice of life that I ran across. It's called Permission to Cry. And it was written by a man whose wife had left him with two small children. And he was trying to raise those two small children by himself as best he could. He said, "I sat alone at the dining room table, surrounded by an otherwise darkened house, and I sat in tears. I'd finally succeeded in getting both kids to bed. There I sat, a relatively new single parent, and I had to somehow try to be both mom and dad to these two little children. I got them both washed. There were shrieks of delight and crazy running around and laughing. But finally they calmed down and lay their heads in their bed. I took my guitar and began to sing a little nighttime lullaby to them. There I was, a recently divorced man with full custody of his children, and I was determined to give them as normal and a stable home as possible. I put on a happy face for them, and I kept their activities as close as I could to how they'd always been. But there, sitting at the dining room table that night, I found myself slumping in my chair, aware that this was the first time since I'd come home from work that I'd been able to just sit down. I'd cooked and served and encouraged two little children to eat. I'd done the dishes, responding to their requests. I'd helped my oldest with her homework. I'd appreciated my youngest drawings. I'd oohed over their elaborate construction of Lego blocks, the bath, the stories, the back rubs, the singing, and now, at long last, a brief moment to myself. Then it all crowded in on me. The fatigue, the weight of responsibility, the worry about bills I wasn't sure I could pay that month, and the endless details of running a house, and the loneliness. I felt as though I were at the bottom of a great sea of loneliness, and it all came together, and I was at once lost, overwhelmed. An unexpected convulsive sobs overtook me, and I sat there silently sobbing. And then a pair of little arms went around my waist, and a little face peered up at me, and I looked down into my five-year-old son's face. I was embarrassed that he caught his father crying, and I said, "I'm sorry, I didn't know you were still awake." I don't know why so many people apologize when they cry, but I was no exception. And then my little boy looked up and said, "It's okay, Daddy. It's okay to cry. You're just a person." And I can't express how happy that made me feel. This little boy, who in the wisdom of innocence gave me permission to cry. He seemed to be saying I didn't have to always be strong, and it was occasionally okay for me to feel weak. He slid up into my lap, and we hugged and talked for a while, and I took him back to his bed and tucked him in. And somehow it was possible for me to get sleep that night. And it was possible for me to say, "Thank you, son." One of the most painful experiences for us to go through, isn't it? And yet, as painful as it is, our society trivializes marriage. I imagine 90% of you have watched a television show, in part or in total, called I Want to Be a Millionaire. It's only been a month or so where there was a sequel to that or an addendum to that that said, Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire? And two people in front of this nation made an absolute farce of the institution of marriage. Any way you want to cut it, they made an absolute farce of it. And it was one of the most widely watched television shows, as ratings go, in America. Darva Conger, Rick Rockwell. I'm not even going to tell you what happened because you know. And if you don't know, just ask the person sitting next to you because they do. But it's absolutely no secret, but it doesn't hide the tragedy, that marriage has become a disposable institution in America. America has the highest divorce rate of any civilized nation. And I use the word civilized with some reservation. Barbara Whitehead wrote a book and called The Divorce Culture. And I just want to extract a few thoughts from her book. She's not a Christian writer. She's a sociologist, psychologist. And I guess I wish she were a Christian writer because that would be better for her, but I'm kind of glad she isn't, because she reaches some of the very same conclusions that Christians reach because of the Bible, but she reaches it from a sociological standpoint. And she makes a powerful case for the positive effects of marital stability and the corrosive nature of our sky-high divorce rate. She states, and I quote, divorce is now part of everyday American life. It's embedded in our laws and movies and television shows, our novels and children's stories, and our closest and most important relationships. She adds, divorce has moved from the margins of society to the mainstream of American life in the space of three short decades. Now you ponder that. 3 decades ago, I was a junior in college. And divorce today is not a bigger deal than breaking up with someone you went steady with when I went to high school. It carries virtually no stigma. In fact, I believe that some of us who have not been divorced are almost looked upon as oddities today. And just 3 short decades, the divorced were the odd, and now those of us who happen to have a belief in monogamy and a lifelong relationships are by far the minority. We find in the Old Testament a practice of polygamy, where a man would have more than one wife at a time. Today we find in America the practice of serial monogamy, where one would have mate after mate after mate. The end result is the same. A man dies and he's had multiple wives. And the ramifications may even be more tragic. Well, Jesus addressed this issue in his day too, didn't he? And he faced a culture that was just as scandal-ridden in the area of family and the home and marriage as you and I do. And it was scandal-ridden among religious leaders. They had taken the words of God from Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, to support their position that marriage was a disposable institution. And God never intended it that way, did he? Therefore, Jesus tells us in Mark chapter 10, at the beginning of the creation of God, he made them male and female, and for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. Well, what I've described for you this morning is man's plan for marriage. And it's pretty pathetic, isn't it? Marriage in the family has changed dramatically over the last 2 to 4 decades. And part of the problem is many of us grew up with unrealistic expectations, and women probably succumb to this a little bit more than men, but not totally. My generation grew up watching Ward and June Cleaver, Ozzie and Harriet Nelson, and the Waltons. Unrealistic portraits of family life. I don't dress like this for supper. And most of you don't either. And sometimes we get chagrin when our expectations don't reach the heights that we anticipate. Now, I think it's important before we enter in too much further this week to understand, at least in my belief, there are no perfect marriages represented here. My marriage isn't perfect. Even if my wife were, I'm not. So our marriage isn't perfect. Your marriage isn't perfect. Because you're not perfect. It's kind of like looking for the perfect church. I've never found the perfect congregation, and if I ever found it, as soon as I joined it, it wouldn't be. But having said that, it doesn't keep us from having good marriages and good congregations. And that's what we're striving for. I want to spend just a little background time. I know we've gone there before, but I don't know how to address the family without touching on some pivotal passages, and I want to take you back to Genesis chapter 2 and remind us of the foundation that we have to build on. It would be easy for me this week to just skip Genesis chapter 2 because you all know it and move on to the hot potato issues. We'll have plenty of time, at least in my opinion, plenty of time for those. But sometimes on this topic, it's a little bit like studying the Bible. We want to jump to Revelation, and the reason we don't understand Revelation is we haven't studied the rest of the Bible that leads up to Revelation. Some of the times we have trouble with the hot potato issues is we've forgotten the foundational things. And if you get upset with me because of my position on some of these issues, that's absolutely correct. I only ask you to look at the Bible and make sure that you're getting upset at the right person, because I hope I'm portraying God's position, not my position. But in Genesis chapter 2, verse 23, 24, and 25, we have the pivotal beginning of God's plan. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman because she is taken out of the man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh, and they are both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed." I'm going to give you 5 reasons for marriage under God's plan. I'm going to give them to you briefly. I don't think this audience is one that will need a lot of persuading as to the accuracy of these, but I think it's important for us to have. And part of what I'm going to try to do with you this week is not simply teach you, it's to refresh your memory so you can help us teach those downstairs. Because we can't simply address this issue at 2-week meetings. It has to be addressed in the home, and it has to be addressed in local congregations. Number one, reason for marriage, and these aren't in order of import, this is just in order of listing, is companionship. In Genesis chapter 2, when all was said and done, the first thing that God said was not good, that man was alone. That doesn't mean a man or a woman has to get married. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 makes it very clear that there are benefits to not getting married. But he also understood, and Holy Spirit understood, that most of us will have that inclination. So the Lord in Genesis chapter 2 looked at Adam and said, this isn't good. So he made companionship. Secondly, procreation. I think I mentioned this in passing, I don't remember this week or last week, that in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, when we're told to be fruitful and multiply, that's the only commandment God has given us that we've consistently kept. And it's not because we're spiritual, it's because we have a human desire there. Third reason for marriage is pleasure, sexual pleasure. This book that we call the Song of Solomon, wonderful expose on a man and his chosen mate sexually enjoying themselves. There's nothing dirty about it. Most of us, my age and older, were still a little puritanical in our comfortability with discussing it, and I don't think that's all bad. I think it's quite appropriate to be appropriate. But there is absolutely nothing ungodly about sexual pleasure in a marriage. In fact, Paul teaches us in 1 Corinthians 7, for a man or a woman to deprive their mate of that is ungodly. And I may return to that, but let me warn you, ladies, that is one of the areas of power you may have over your mate, but if you use that in a bartering sense, you are absolutely courting disaster. And if disaster ensues because you've done that, I will feel sorry for you, but only this much. Reason number four is spiritual fullness. I believe when God said it's not good for man to be alone, he was not simply talking about physically. I think he was talking about spiritually. I was talking to a man earlier this year who's somewhat older than me. He's lost his wife, had lost his wife, and he expressed to me, and I'll have to paraphrase because I don't remember the exact quote, he referenced his age and he says, yes, I miss the sexual intimacy, but at my age what I miss most is not sexual intimacy, it's spiritual intimacy. Having someone to visit about spiritual things. I thought he was right on. Reason number five is that it's a prototype to prepare us for our marriage to Christ. Revelation chapter 19, verses 7 through 10. It's a prototype. We don't have to be married in order to be married to Christ, but it is a prototype for that. Now let me make a couple of more comments about Genesis 2 and then I'll stop for comments. I know this is basic, but I don't want to make the mistake of trying to build the third and fourth floors without at least making sure we've got the first and second floors. I believe in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, there are three tremendously important concepts for a marriage to be successful. Number one is severance. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother. When a couple becomes married, they form a new family unit. And one of the greatest threats to a family unit is a new family unit is overly adhering to a past family unit. When Donna and I got married, I was still the son of my parents. She was still the daughter of her parents, but those relationships changed and they changed forever. And unless a couple makes an emotional severance from their parents, their marriage is at a minimum only going to be partially successful, and at a maximum it will be an absolute disaster. Mothers and fathers, you've got to let them go. And I don't have anybody in mind that's here today when I say this, but mothers, if you're used to talking to your daughters every day, they get married, you got to quit that. I know mothers and mothers-in-laws who still make daily contact with their children even after they're married, I think that is absolutely playing with fire. Now, yeah, that's my opinion, but it happens to be right. I'm not saying that we don't honor our parents. I'm saying it changes. And I know of grown, my age, children who still daily can't get through the day without talking to mom or dad. Absolute disaster. Because there has not been severance. Point number two. They're to cleave. The purpose there or the principle is permanency. The word there literally means to be glued together. A husband and a wife are to cleave. It's like super glue. And those of you that have ever dabbled with super glue know that if you glue it in the wrong spot and try to get it apart, when you break it apart, it doesn't break at the seam you glued. It breaks somewhere else. Because the glue is stronger than the wood. And that's exactly what happens in a marriage. God glues a husband and a wife together. If they choose to pull that apart, I can almost guarantee you it will not pull apart nicely at the seam. It will break in a jagged way and both partners will be damaged. Not to speak of the children. Point number three that we have here is the concept of unity and intimacy. It's called one flesh. I happen to believe this concept of they shall be one flesh is a reference to physical intimacy, but I don't believe it stops there. I think they're to be emotional and spiritually one. And that's why it's so important, if at all possible, when, and I'll hit this one fairly hard downstairs, that when we select our mates, that we have someone that we can be spiritually and emotionally in sync with. Now, I don't personally take the hard-line position that you have to marry in the church, but I certainly will extol that that is by far, far, far the wisest thing to do. But if a young person finds someone, and we have young people downstairs who simply aren't close, I mean in proximity to people in the church, and sometimes you fall in love, but always, I tell them, always try to find someone you can spiritually work with and bring them at least to the Lord. Because that intimacy will never be as great as the Lord had anticipated it being. I'm going to pause. I can't believe what the clock says. And I know this is very basic, but I want to give you a chance to ask some questions and make some comments and to disagree. I jokingly say I'm right, but nobody's always right on this issue. Even if you think you got all the answers, you're just a heartbeat from understanding you don't know much. Tom. Do you have that? Would you like to read it? Okay. Okay. For sake of the tape, Tom was referencing Ephesians chapter 5, verse 32, and his comment was that really ties the divine and the spiritual element of marriage into this, and it's not simply a physical union, although the physical desires that God has given us is certainly an appropriate part of it. Jay? Or I thought I saw a hand over here. Okay, that's what you were going to say. Joanne? I guess you could get caller ID. Her question was, how do you get the children from quit calling home? Caller ID, there's a sister in Topeka that had three girls, and when each one got married, she sold their bedroom suits so they couldn't come back. they do sometimes have a tendency to return. And we'll talk a little bit about this when we get to wounded parents. But since you brought it up, I'll make a comment. I think I'm not there yet, so I can't speak from personal experience, but parenting may almost be as hard after they're married as it is before, because you've got to exercise tremendous self-discipline. If we're not careful, it seems to me, and I've seen this happen, parents whose children are married and then something goes a little shaky in that marriage can inadvertently become enablers of their children by overly sympathizing with them. And sometimes the most loving thing to do might be to say, hey, you're on your own. Now, that's easier to say than it is to do, and I'm not saying that's always the case, but if a parent is repeatedly and always there to bail out their children when they should be adults, I question whether or not we're doing them a favor. I think we may simply be enabling their adolescence. And that's true of teens. It's a prayerful thing, but someone once described raising teenagers as like holding on to a boat with a rope, and you got to let go of the rope so the boat can go out into the water. And if you don't let go of the rope, the boat's never going to leave. But if you hold on too tight, it's going to burn your hands, and it takes a lot of prayerful knowledge to know how much to let them. But I think, in general, once they say I do, they took a big step, and this sounds cold, but to a great extent, they're on their own. And I'm not saying we should never help them, but I think we ought to be very thoughtful about how we help them. Because bailing kids out, you know, even in little things, traffic tickets. I started to say, if my boys ever get them, but let me be honest, when they got them, they were on their own. They were on their own. They paid for it, the whole bit. Because I'd rather them do that than get the idea this is no big deal and then have to go scrape them off of a tree sometime. And the same thing may be true with marriage. You may have to cut the cord. You may have to almost be distant. Now, I know that's awful hard. Richard?
I read a little article one time that emphasized that. A girl and a particular husband, she called home to her father, Daddy, can I come home? And his answer was, you are home.
I'm going to repeat that for the tape. That's about the best thing you said all week, Richard. Is that in James? It ought to be. I'm sure glad you're here. Richard was telling a story, and I'm doing this for the tape because that's so good. A young daughter was married and had a little problem with her husband, called home and said, Daddy, can I come home? And her daddy said, you are home. That was a wise father. Don't enable our children. We can inadvertently stimulate the breakup of the very thing we want to happen the least.
You've heard the excuse of a couple breaking up because they wanted more. Your basic approach to this basically is that you covered the important elements of what not to do.
Sure. And you often do hear, and Glenn's comment was, people will break up because they want something else. They want to be fulfilled. And we'll talk about this when we get into myths of marriage, but your mate was never intended to meet all of your needs. If your mate could meet all of your needs, you wouldn't need Jesus Christ. As hard as I try, I can't meet all of Donna's needs. But I was never intended to, thank goodness. And this false fantasy of what home life is, it has led many people to think, I'm not totally happy, therefore something must be wrong, and we'll go to plan B. And oftentimes what's missing is the Lord. What's missing is the Lord. Anybody else? Jerry? Okay. Jerry's comment was we need to be very careful about these so-called talk shows. On TV, and I can honestly say I'm not addicted, but as you sometimes channel surf, I can't think of one I would recommend. That doesn't mean there aren't any. There might be one or two on the radio that have some redeeming qualities, but I can't think of a single one that I've ever seen on TV that I'd recommend. And it just amazes me that their ratings are so high, because it's... I'd rather study calculus than listen to some of them, and that's painful. That's painful. Was it Mike? Did I have a... No, Kathy's here now. Okay. With the calculus?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be painful if you helped me.
We also, I agree with your comments about separating from the parents, but we still can have a good relationship with them.
Yes. And go ahead.
At the same time, there may come a point in their life where they need to be back in our home.
Sure. I think you can hear Mike, because his voice does carry. And when I say separate, that's not necessarily geographical. It seems to me that it's a spiritual and an emotional separation that's more important. Now, we tend to get geographically separated, and that can be a short-term blessing. I used to recommend to all young people to move at least 3 hours away from their parents when they got married. As our boys got older, I quit recommending that, because it just didn't seem quite as good an idea to me. But it does force a young couple for at least a period of time to stand on their own and get that thing established. But I know some of you have cared for elderly parents. I think in Mike and Kathy's situation, I don't know if cared for is the appropriate word, but she cared for them. But you can have an emotional, spiritual severance and even live next door. Now, you need to be careful. Most of us couldn't carry that out, but some can. Some can. Dolores?
We're never a daughter, and a stepdaughter.
Right.
I do feel there's a little distant relationship between mother and daughter. My husband was a daughter.
Brenda? Oh, joke. You're second. Brenda? Well, I think if she's not going to take a look at passages like Genesis chapter 2, I mean, how many times does the Bible have to say it before it's important? I'm not trying to give you a flippant answer, but it's clear there to me, and she just, it's between what she wants and what God's told her. And she's got to come to grips with it. Yes. Okay. I'm smiling just because I knew I'd hit some buttons here this week. I found one. Talk about mothers and daughters talking on the phone, and but in-laws and children can have a good relationship. My parents like my wife better than they like me. That's okay. I mean, they'd rather her come visit than me. That's fine. Yeah. And that's fine too. Pat? The question is it more of a problem for the male ego if the wife calls the mother or the father? I don't know. I can see it being both. What usually sometimes happens is it can portray a sense that you don't really think I can provide and take care of you. Therefore, you have to be constantly checking back at home. That's the problem I've seen, and I think it could happen either way. And I'm not talking about never talking to your mom and dad. I'm not talking about not having a good relationship. I'm just talking about when you get married, your husband and wife is the predominant person in your life, and they have to replace your parents as the predominant person in your life. Milford. Yeah, it'd be nice to do that before we get married, but at least afterwards. We shouldn't be. We should be. It's amazing to me how many people live and die and never grow up, but I totally agree with your sentiment. Tom?
I think probably one of the most dangerous things, as we say, we should maintain good contact with our parents, but we're not to lean on them, that's the point. And I observe that you spoke of the daughter-father relationship. I observe that for a man, a young man married, clinging to his mother, the mother-son relationship can actually be as damaging as the daughter-father relationship.
I'm sure that's true. Different people are different. The point I want to emphasize is that when a couple gets married, they form a new family unit, and that takes priority over the past family unit. It doesn't dissolve it, but it has to take priority over it, or it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when are you going to start having problems. And sometimes as parents, the most loving thing I think we can do for our kids is to force them, if they're not so inclined, to form that new family unit. Was there one over here, Jay?
Yeah, as our example, Rebecca and I have lived in a separate city from either one of our parents for going on 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has helped prepare us for now that her parents have had to live close to help us.
Okay. Now, I would think that was quite possible. I think that is quite possible. Janice? Mm-hmm.
But the same problem comes from the later end of marriage when the married couple's parents are having problems. Jay started to refer to that. When your parents' health is failing, you also get the urgent. And often we deal with the urgent instead of the important sometimes. And we have to remember that our mate is still as important to us as they ever were. And our parents' health needs are very important. In other words, don't be
I understand what you're saying. I just don't know if it's right. Okay, Joanne's tried everything. You may be to the point of moving and not leaving a forwarding address. But seriously, the point is, you know, we wean our children when they're young from the bottle, and as they move from the nest, there's a weaning process that has to occur. That has to occur for them to survive in the fullest sense, in my humble opinion. Okay. We will move into headship and move along tomorrow. Probably I'll use a similar format each day. Try to take about 40 to 45 minutes to present material and then leave 15 minutes for discussion. If I don't do that, we'll discuss for 45 minutes and have 15 minutes of material. And this was very introductory, but I want to leave time for blended families and wounded parents for sure, because those are two that I've not dealt with in this format. Brad, did you ring the buzzer? Class, and some of which I wish you had been willing to make during class, but I'm glad you made them. One lady was making a comment when her boss found out she was getting married, that she got some good advice, and it was along the lines of, now the two of you will have to make all your decisions. The implication being parents are no longer part of that decision-making process. And I thought that was pretty good advice. I guess I think it because I agree with it. Another one came up to me, another person came up to me and shared with me a personal story that, at least in their opinion, their marriage was saved by putting some geographical distance between them and their parents. And I thought that was very compelling. Doesn't mean that has to be the way it is, but the concept of severance, I think, is an important concept. I'd ask you for any more comments, but I know that I'd never get to what I need to cover today. So I'm going to wait and ask you for comments in a little bit. I want to spend maybe the first 15 or 20 minutes on the concept of headship. Head, in the Greek, is kephale. K-E-P-H-A-L-E. And Paul uses this term numerous times in his writings. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3 was a passage that we visited in our discussion of Gnosticism as it relates to the church, but it's one that we need to touch on even only for a few moments this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and I'm going to be going down pretty much as best I can the sheet on, I think it's page 14. I got down a couple of bullets yesterday, but I need to complete that sheet and the next sheet today. In 1 Corinthians 11:3, we have the word head three times. I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. Now, oftentimes we connotate terms in order to make them more politically correct or more palatable to people when we talk to them. The word head has undergone quite a bit of discussion in the last two or three decades. And one of the concepts that's been proposed is that in this passage, when it says that the head of the woman is the man, that head there means source. Like you might say the head of the Mississippi River, and you'd go up into Minnesota and find the head, or the source of it. But almost every legitimate biblical scholar doesn't translate and doesn't consider the word head to be defined as source, as Paul uses it here in 1 Corinthians 11:3. Rather, it carries with it the concept of authority. And I think just a rather simple exegesis of this third verse would indicate it can't mean source, because it says, and the head of Christ is God. If you translate head as origin or source, then you're saying the origin of Christ is God, and Christ then becomes a created being, which just totally throws the deity of Christ out the window. And again, we spent much time last week on it, as that's one of the basic tenets of Gnosticism. So here you have an example that when you try to interpret this passage and make head the origin or source, you're really playing right into the Gnostic hand, whether we call it that or not. I believe what this passage is giving us is the divine order, and it's talking about authority. Now, as we go through this discussion on headship, I'm going to try to make what I think is a very important distinction between authority and power. I don't think this is talking about the power that the man has over the woman, but rather the authority. And if you don't see that distinction, I'm just going to ask you to hold with me for a little bit as we go down through some of these concepts. Another problem with looking at this as anything other than authority is when you go to Ephesians chapter 1, verse 22, we have the same word translated head, and there it's talking about the relationship of Christ to the church. And hath put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church. And there it's plainly talking about Christ having the authority as the head over the church. Now in Ephesians chapter 5, which you're probably all familiar with, we do have the statement in this same context, for the husband is the head of the wife, notice this next phrase, even as Christ is the head of the church. In other words, in Ephesians 5:23, head or headship means what it meant back in Ephesians 1:22. Christ is the head of the church. The man is the head of the woman. And it carries, I believe, the concept of authority. It carries with it the concept of chain of command, if you will. Now, the troublesome thing for some people as they try to consider this concept of headship is this visual or emotional picture that men are larger, stronger, and therefore headship is something that connotates the right to control, to dominate, to intimidate, or to run the whole show. And there isn't anything that's any further from the concept of Christian marital headship than those words, in my opinion. Remember that even though Jesus possessed a chain of command and was head of the church, in his earthly ministry, he exercised that headship as a what? Servant. Mark chapter 10, verse 45. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. Now he's the head, but it's a headship of ministry and service, rather than a headship of power. Now you can make the argument, and I think it's valid, that the ultimate power comes through service and ministry. But that's not the way secular man and the world, marriage counselors, what have you, think of this. And oftentimes, and it's a very frustrating thing for many of us as we try to work with people, marriage counselors who aren't Christian, and most of them aren't in their precepts, look at this as a power struggle, and if you can't win the power struggle, get out of the relationship.